Morning. It's good to see everyone here this morning. If you would like to follow along, we're going to be reading a passage in Judges 12 in just a moment. If you'd like to be turning there, I want to remind everyone that next Sunday night we will be doing the question night, where the lesson will be about basically topics that that you might request, and the question box is in the back if you'd like to drop something in there. You know, I want to tell you, just a second ago I was sitting over here, and east is that way, for sure, because occasionally, in the right time of year, where I sit, the sun just kind of comes in that window and it just feels like it's burning you. And it's like right there, it's right on you, and it's in your face, and you can't see it. And I'll be honest with you, I was getting a little irritated with it just a minute ago. And then I kind of turned, you know, a little bit to get it out of my face, and I just saw everybody here. And it kind of put things in perspective a little bit, you know. And I know we all have problems bigger than the sun shining in our face, but maybe sometimes if we just turn and look at the positive stuff in our life and the blessings that God's given us, maybe sometimes we'll realize that these other little problems, they're just temporary, and they're just of this world, and they're just kind of going away. By the time I go back and sit down, the sun will be gone. God will all still be here. And we need to recognize the blessings that God gives us. So that was just a side. That one's free. Judges 12. As you're turning there, a little bit of backstory here. In Judges 12, we see a battle with the men of Gilead and the men of Ephraim. And how did it get to this point? I guess is somewhat important, at least understanding the setting. But Jephthah, who is the subject of most of the few chapters of Judges here, maybe 10, 11, and 12, is a judge of Israel. And he is, we're going to come to find out, the commander of the Gileadites. And so the king of Ammon, to kind of begin back in chapter 11, the king of Ammon had claimed at this point in time, and this is later on in history than the Exodus from Egypt, but he claimed that when that happened, when the people came up out of Egypt, that they had taken some of the Ammonites' land. Well, the truth is the Israelites didn't take the land, and Jephthah tries to kind of explain this to the king, and what he told him was the truth, and he told him that Israel didn't take the land, but rather they just asked to pass through their land. And they did ask to pass through that land. They asked twice, actually. But something about their asking, or about maybe the multitude of the people, calls Sihon, I believe was his name, who was the king of the Amorites at the time, he kind of got nervous. And so he went up to fight the Israelites. They were camped on the border. They weren't in the land. They hadn't taken any land. They were camped on the border. So he went up to fight them, just to make sure his kingdom, I guess, was protected. Well, of course, God delivered them into the hands of the Israelites. The Israelites won. And Jephthah's trying to explain all this so that there's not any more trouble. Well, the king now doesn't want to hear that, or he doesn't agree, or he's still upset about it. And so what happens is there's going to be a fight. And you probably remember this particular fight, because this is the one that is probably Jephthah's most known for, because this is the one where he vows to God that if God will deliver the Ammonites into his hands, that he'll give God the first thing that comes out of his house when he returns from battle. And of course he returns, and God has delivered them into his hands. He's won the battle, and he comes home, and this is when his daughter comes out, his only daughter, his only child, in fact, comes out. And of course, he has to keep his promise to God, his vow to God, and has to sacrifice his only child. Okay, so after this, Ephraim gets in touch with Jephthah, and they're upset. And they say, well, why did you cross over our land and fight these people and not call us? Why didn't you let us know this was going down and everything? So it's on again. There's another battle happening because of this idea of land and crossing land and not letting people know things and everything. So Jephthah again gathers the men of Gilead to fight against Ephraim this time. And Jephthah and the men of Gilead win this battle as well. But it seems like as they were fighting this battle, at some point, the Gileadites kind of flanked the men of Ephraim, and they seized the fords of the Jordan. And so there was a crossing place at the Jordan, and this is the area that they seized. So the point was that anybody who tried to retreat or anybody who was left over after the battle trying to get home, they wouldn't be able to pass through. This was kind of the bottleneck. This was the place. And so those who tried to get through had to pass those men, and they couldn't get past them, and there was no other way. But it's interesting, I think, how they dealt with this. And if you look in Judges 12, if you're there, I want you to look at verse 5. The Gileadites seized the fords of the Jordan before the Ephraimites arrived. And when any Ephraimite who escaped said, "Let me cross over," the men of Gilead would say to him, "Are you an Ephraimite?" If he said no, they would say to him, "Then say Shibboleth." And he would say Sibboleth, for he could not pronounce it right. Then they would take him and kill him at the fords of Jordan. There fell at that time 42,000 Ephraimites. So the people would come and they'd try to cross if they were Ephraimites. Are you an Ephraimite? And they'd lie and they'd say, "No, I'm not an Ephraimite," because they probably know they're going to get killed. And then they would administer this test, this test of the Shibboleth. And the people that were trying to cross, if they were Ephraimites, they would, I guess, fail the test. And that test accounted for 42,000 lives at the fords of Jordan after the battle between the Gileadites and the Ephraimites. I think that's just incredibly interesting. This test, the Shibboleth test. And Shibboleth is just a test of dialect. And so apparently the people of Ephraim, or most of them at least, they couldn't say this word. I guess they couldn't say the sh sound is the point. But, you know, that kind of makes sense to us, I think, if we really think about it. We know certain ethnicities or cultures or regions or even close regions, as the case may be here with these two tribes, that just can't pronounce some words. You know, they just can't say some things. And I'll tell you a good example is I have some family that came up in South Carolina. And maybe not anymore, but the older people over there, they can't pronounce the word daughter. Like if you have I have two daughters, they can't say that. I can't say how they say it, but they don't say that. And so they can't pronounce that word. They can't say Deuteronomy either, but that's a different story. But they can try to say those things, but they can't do it. And so anytime somebody says daughter the way that somebody from South Carolina says daughter, I say, "They're from South Carolina, I can tell." And I don't know why, but that's just the way it is. And I think of things like Boston accents or Canadian accents. Or where's Paul? He's not here. New York accents. You can all think of words that some of these people say that they just don't pronounce it correctly. And I'm probably a good example of this too. You know, a redneck accent. And there's things that I don't say that are correct. But this Shibboleth is just a simple test to see if the Ephraimites were with the men that were on God's side. And so I think some people today just long for this. They just want, you know, some magic word. They just want some, you know, silver bullet, this golden ticket, you know, to get into heaven. And so they come up with things many times like creeds or certain prayers or just chants or just something that if we do this, then we're okay. We can pass through. We're not going to be destroyed. Well, I'm here to tell you, brethren, there's no magic word. And let me just tell you this, too, while we're on this. My list that I just mentioned to you of some things that people consider as the magic word, you know, you might be thinking, well, yeah, this group does that, I know that, and this group does that, and I know that. But before we get too far up on our horse, you know, in some ways, this is a trap that we fall into as bad and maybe worse than some of these others do. Maybe just by the fact that we say, we don't have creeds. We're set. We don't have certain prayers that we say. We're good. Or maybe we say, I'm at service every single time. So that's kind of the litmus test. I'm set. Or we say, you know, I give this much in contribution. Or I lead singing. Or I preach. And preachers can fall into this thing too. This thing. How about this? I've been baptized with the right baptism. Do we kind of wear that as a badge sometimes and say, I'm set. It's all good. I've done what I need to do. I've passed the test. I've said shibboleth with the H. Sometimes we do that too, and we have to be careful of that and not just look at others and say, we need to make sure that we don't do what they do. We don't need to be like the one standing afar off saying, I thank God that I'm not like this person. We need to look at ourselves and we need to see that sometimes there are things that we attach ourselves to that can cause us to think that this is the magic word. Well, as I said before, there's just no magic word. And we need to realize that if we think that, if we have even just a smidgen of that kind of mentality, we're just wrong. And we need to correct it. I think of the rich young ruler. Turn to Matthew 19. I want to read this account because we're going to talk about this in a moment as well. But in Matthew 19, I want to look at this account because of how it's recorded here. In Matthew 19, beginning in verse 16, now behold, one came and said to him, good teacher, what good thing shall I do that I may have eternal life? And he said to him, why do you call me good? No one is good but one, that is God. But if you want to enter into life, keep the commandments. And he said to him, which ones? Jesus said, you shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness. Honor your father and mother, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. The young man said to him, all these things I have kept from my youth. What do I still lack? And Jesus said to him, if you want to be perfect, go. And that's complete. If you want to be complete, go sell what you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. And come follow me. But when the young man heard that saying, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. You notice what he said? He said here in verse 16 of Matthew 19, good teacher, what good thing must I do? What good thing? It seems to me that he's saying here, what's the magic word? What's the key? What do I need to do? Maybe he's thinking with this money, this great wealth that he has, maybe I need to build a synagogue where all these people can come and worship, and this will provide a place of worship for all these people, and that will be my legacy. That will be what I do. That will be this great thing that I need to do. But as we just read, you see what the Lord basically tells him? He says, it's not just some good thing. He says, it's everything. He said, it's not this, it's not that, it's not the other, it's everything. That's what's required. So there's not this magic word. But having said all that, I think that we should understand as Christians that we do have a shibboleth. We do have this thing. Our shibboleth is not something that we say. It's not something that we have to pronounce correctly, but rather it's something that we live. It's something that we are. I would propose to you this morning that our shibboleth is our faith. I want to talk just a moment about that. I hope in the coming months, with really no rhyme or reason, but to present some lessons on faith. And so kind of in a way of setting the stage for that, I want to talk just generally about faith for a second and maybe some shortcomings that we can find in faith at times. I think people generally too often make a huge mistake in believing that faith is just a feeling. You know, it's just something that I feel. Do you have faith? Yeah, I got faith. I feel it. It's there. If I just have faith that Jesus came and that Jesus is the Son of God, if I just believe that, then I've done it. I've correctly pronounced shibboleth. I've found the key. I've found the word. And too many times they just feel as though that's it. That's all there is to faith. Well, let me just tell you, that's not a biblical definition of what faith is. And we're going to look at that more in just a second. But I'll also tell you another type of person that I think makes a large mistake when it comes to faith. And kind of the way I put it is that they put too much emphasis on their faith. And let me explain what I mean by that, because that could be misunderstood maybe in the way I said it. But they're kind of not thinking that it's a feeling, but maybe it's the exact opposite. Maybe it's some kind of legalistic type idea of faith. And that's these people who might say, I'm faithful and my faith is sufficient. And that's what I'm going to obey enough and I'm going to believe enough that's going to be enough. I'm going to do enough as far as my faith is concerned and belief in everything to gain salvation. And I tell you, I think that's a trap that maybe we can fall into sometimes. That we have this great faith and we're doing these things and we believe. And remember the rich young ruler we just read about. What do I need to do to inherit eternal life? And he said, keep the commandments, this, and this. And you remember he was quick to say, I've kept all that from my youth. I've done my part. Is almost what he's saying to me. And I kind of wonder sometimes if he was just expecting Jesus to say, well, you're set then. If you've done all that, you're good. And maybe we kind of feel the same way. It's hard to talk about faith and not go to Hebrews 11. Appreciate what Doug read this morning, but turn to Hebrews 11. In Hebrews 11, I think it's 18 times in this chapter, that we read the words, by faith. And then we read about these great historical characters. And every time we see the word, by faith, we see a great historical character, and then we see something they did. We don't see anything about a feeling they had. We see those people doing something. There's nowhere in Hebrews 11 that we just read that it's a feeling, that it's something that's just not ever manifest in any way whatsoever. Every time we see faith in Hebrews 11, we see it displayed. We see something tangible. And we need to understand that. It's never abstract. It's never just emotion. This is the biblical definition of faith, is some type of action. But then these others who maybe put too much emphasis on their own faith and believe that that's what's going to just carry them to heaven, I want to look at three passages in Hebrews 11 here. Verse 6, first of all, but without faith it is impossible to please Him, for he who comes to God must believe that He is and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Now look at verse 16. But now they desire a better, that is a heavenly country. Therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. And then lastly, let's look at verse 39. And all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise, God having provided something better for us. Okay. So from these two passages, we see that we must believe that he is, and he is the rewarder of those who diligently seek him. We see that they desired a better place and that God was preparing the city for them. We see that God has provided something better for us in 39 and 40. So, what does that mean? Well, what it means is, after all these things that these people did to show their faith, these tangible things that we just talked about, by faith, somebody did something. So after all that, doesn't it look like they're still relying on God to give them a reward? What did their faith do? They didn't earn anything, did they? It still looks like from these three passages that I read in the exact same chapter of the Bible that we talk about these actions that faith are put into, it looks like the fact is that God's grace is just as essential as their faith, and it is. And that's what we have to realize. We have to realize that these two are mixed together. And these people, the people who believe that their faith maybe is going to carry them, they have a very inaccurate understanding of the grace of God. Turn to Romans 5. Romans 5, you know, maybe as far as grace is understood, is maybe one of the most clarifying passages, at least in my mind. I know we all see some passages differently as far as what really, you know, drives points home with us. But Romans 5, verse 1 and 2, you know, really kind of clarify a lot, at least for me. Therefore, having been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom also we have access by faith into this grace. We have access to the grace by faith, is what it says, in which we stand and rejoice in hope, the glory of God. So there's a hope that we're trying to obtain. We attain that hope solely through the grace of God, but the only way to get into that grace is through faith. So it's just this clear natural progression for me. Let's remember that maybe this is a category that we can fall into, and we need to be careful not to rely solely on our own faith, on ourselves. Okay, so let's go back to the Gileadites in this test of the shibboleth. I want to mention three things very briefly that strike me about this. And I hope what we can do with these three things is we can take them and compare our faith and maybe grow a little bit. And I'll just tell you, I'm not going to get very in-depth with each one of these points, because what I hope you'll do is I hope you'll just kind of think about it and meditate on it a little bit and consider some of these things and think about where we can better ourselves in perspective, but also in action as far as our faith is concerned. The first thing that strikes me about this is the Ephraimites were apparently unaware they were mispronouncing the word. You ever thought about that? I mean, if they knew, if I knew, well, I can't say that word correctly. Well, I'd have run, or I'd have, you know, not answered the question or something. But apparently they didn't know that. And if you remember the people that we talked about from the different regions and everything, have you ever been close enough to somebody who doesn't say something right to say, hey, you're not saying that right? You know, most of the times they don't realize it. They don't know that they're not saying that right. They think they're saying it right. And you know what? Maybe they are. Maybe you're saying it wrong. Dad and I were up in Maine hunting, and they have a heavy brogue up in Maine. I don't know if you've ever talked to any Mainers, but I can barely understand them. But Dad said the word scallop, you know, the seafood. And they didn't even know what he was saying at first. And I don't know if he was saying it wrong or if they were saying it wrong. But everybody thought they were right. But the point is, nobody knew they were wrong. Nobody even realized they were saying something wrong. And so the application for us is that what this is a lack of self-awareness. And maybe we need to be a little more self-aware. We have to be self-aware. We have to understand where we are. And that takes study. It takes holding up our lives against the truth of God, the revealed will that He's given to us. And you know what? Sometimes that takes help from others. And maybe that's hard for us sometimes. Maybe that's harder than we even want to admit sometimes. One of the great self-aware people who were self-aware in the Bible is found in Acts 8, I think. Turn there if you would. Here we see the Ethiopian eunuch, and a familiar story as Philip goes and is teaching this man and ultimately converts him. But before we read this, we need to remember who this person was. You remember, he was basically an aide to the queen, Candace. And so he was an important person. He was very powerful, probably very smart, because of his role and the things that he was in charge of. But what did he say to Philip? Look in verse 30 of Acts 8. So Philip ran to him and heard him reading the prophet Isaiah and said, "Do you understand what you're reading?" And he said, "How can I unless someone guides me?" And he asked Philip to come up and sit with him. So Philip says, "Do you understand what you're reading?" And this great, powerful, smart, important man basically says, "No, I don't have a clue. How am I supposed to understand this?" He asked for help. So we can find ourselves being proud and not self-aware. And so we have to figure out for ourselves whether we're going to be willing to ask for help when we need help. Are we self-aware enough? Do we realize where our flaws are? Do we even understand? "Oh yeah, I understand." You ever had somebody ask you about something? "Do you understand that?" "Oh yeah, I understand." And you don't have a clue. Well, that's pride, is what that is. That's an unwillingness. Maybe it's not being self-aware, but maybe it's just an unwillingness. And I'm just going to tell you, brethren, we can't be people like Ahab or like Pilate or like all these other people in the Bible who are just stubborn and can't be told anything to do and are not willing to listen to things that are right, but are kind of stuck in their ways because nobody's going to tell them what to do. We can't be people who never take an honest look at themselves and hold their lives up to the Bible and recognize that we have flaws and are willing to work on those flaws. If we sit in these pews and we think we all got it all figured out, we're lost. Because we all need help. And we need to be aware of that. And we need to be willing to ask for help. We don't need to be like these poor Ephraimites who came up and they just thought they were passing through maybe and they said, "Sibboleth," and then they're dead. We've got to be a little more self-aware than that. Second thing that strikes me about this test of the Sibboleth is that it was so simple. I mean, it was a simple test that was administered to these people. They weren't asked to do something extraordinary. They weren't given a complex math problem and said, "Figure this out or we're going to kill you." Why is that? Well, so it could be administered to anyone and to everyone so that no one would fail the test unless the reason that they failed the test was because they were on the wrong side. So it was simple. And the test for us, our faith, There's nothing so hard or complicated about that if you're truly on the right side, you can pass that test. There's nothing too complicated for anybody here, anybody in this world, who's of sound mind. There's nobody who can't pass that test. So you don't have to be a smart person. In fact, as you read through the Bible,